And in here on a highway turned into a lake. Born on this planet that I didn't make. The ice caps are melting, you can measure the rise of the poisoned oceans, hear all the lies of the political pundits and corporate crooks. Their accountants and scientists cooking the books with hardly an inkling of what it's about. Wedded to profit in flood and in drought, I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. Amidst mountains of soil, washed up farmland covered in oil, 1 ton every acre, lost every year, and along with the pesticides it ends up right here. Millions of miles of chemical wheat, challenging all to try to compete and lay waste to your country like we've done to ours. Let them eat coffee, sugar, coca, and flowers. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. City shrouded in smoke, 10 million people this morning awoke to a future of cancer, industrial disease. So let's build some more suburbs and buy SUVs, cut down the mountains, burn all the coal, and put all the money in a humongous bowl. They'll call it progress and they'll blame it on you to end life as we know it, to enrich the few. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. Yes, I speak to you now from an occupied place. You might call it your home or a terrorist base. They'll send your sons and your daughters to make sure that it's theirs, while they sit in their mansions in plush leather chairs. And everyone's waiting for us to decide. In dust we were born and in dust we reside. Will we realize the commons is to shepherd and share here in this war zone called land, water, and air? I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is Confronting Climate Change. The urgency of the climate crisis has compelled writers such as Bill McKibben and Antonia Hujas to cross the line into advocacy. Bill McKibben says that 75% of Americans know that climate change is real and want something done about it.
Welcome to Climate One, a conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. To understand any of them, you have to understand them all. I'm Greg Dalton. Today we're talking with writers and advocates Bill McKibben and Antonia Hujas about the nexus between journalism and advocacy in the age of climate disruption. Moving the global economy away from fossil fuels is the biggest undertaking in human history. The urgency and scale of that imperative has compelled Bill McKibben and other writers to cross the line into direct political action. It has also compelled Antonia Hujas and others to step out of policy roles into writing and advocacy. Over the next hour, we'll talk with Bill McKibben and Antonia Hujas about the role of writers and advocates and issues such as fossil fuels, divestiture, renewable energy, climate chaos, and a lot more. Along the way, we'll include questions from our live audience at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. Bill McKibben is author of Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet, and co-founder of 350.org, which advocates for a clean energy future. Antonia Hujas is director of the Energy Program at Global Exchange, a human rights organization. Her most recent book is Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Please welcome them to Climate One. Thank you both. So, Antonia, let's begin with you. You were a staffer in Congress, and then you left there because you thought you'd have more impact writing and doing other things. So tell us about that path.
Sure. So I have both an undergraduate and graduate degree in public policy and went to work on Capitol Hill for some pretty amazing members of Congress and went there to try and impact public policy. And like I said, I worked for great members. There was amazing staff, amazing other members of Congress, lots of people there to do the right thing. But I was increasingly confronted with the fact that we really weren't able to do what we went there to do on behalf of our constituents. And the more that I struggled with this problem, the more that it came to me that the primary obstacle I felt was the role of major corporations dominating our political system. And the more I looked at major corporations, the more I went to the top, which was the largest of those corporations and most profitable, the oil industry, and decided that the way I could be most effective on trying to get policies implemented that I thought were important and meaningful would be to leave Capitol Hill and to work on research and writing and advocacy, specifically addressing the operations of the oil industry, its activities, its impacts, and its impact on the activities of the federal government. And just to update my bio a bit, I'm no longer with Global Exchange. I have a fellowship with the Investigative Reporting Program at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, focusing on investigative journalism and research into the oil industry, in particular, its relationship, oil and natural gas, and their relationship to the war in Afghanistan.
Thanks for that. Yeah, we got that from your book, which you're right, it's updated. So Bill McKibben, you wrote one of the first book on climate change, End of Nature, in 1989. And what prompted you to go from writing into action and advocacy?
Well, I'm a much slower learner than Antonio. I was a journalist, straight ahead. It's what I did growing up and then in college, and then I went to work at the New Yorker afterwards, and that was the first 5 years of my life out of college. And then I wrote The End of Nature. I, at some level, knew as I was writing it that I was not objective in that I did not wish the planet to burn up and, blow away. I was like not even in. But it didn't occur to me that my job was to do more than write about it, in a sense. I was 27, I guess, when I was writing The End of Nature. And my theory of change was people will read my book and then they will change. And they did actually read the book. It was a bestseller. It was in 24 languages, something like that. But that's actually not, it turns out, how it works. But as I say, slow learner. I spent much of the next 15 years just sort of writing, continuing to write about all this, and expecting at some point that reason would prevail. The worst thing in the world was happening. The scientists were explaining to us what was going on. Sooner or later, something would happen. And finally, it just, empiricism had its way with me, and it was clear we weren't getting anywhere. And that's when we started trying to organize. And, we formed 350.org, and it's grown into this big global grassroots campaign, and it's all, it's only now, sort of all these years later, that I'm figuring out what Antonia figured out in the course of months, which is that the reason we get no change is because of the incredible power of the fossil fuel industry. And unless we can change that balance of power some, unless we can weaken them some and build a movement strong enough to take them on, we never will get change. And so that's why we, try to do what we do. I'm still, think of myself as a writer and a journalist, above all else, though you wouldn't know it from sort of what I spend most of my hours doing anymore, I guess. But, and I continue to think that reason is a very useful thing. At this point, though, reason is what we use to try and rouse the movement that might then go and beat the completely unreasonable force of the fossil fuel industry.
And we'll get to that, but let's stick on reason. We've had a number of discussions here that facts don't compel people to change. There's enough facts out there. If we were logical and we saw the abundance of scientific evidence and things, wouldn't change have happened by now?
I actually don't really buy that. There's been this endless, pursuit of how people should message about climate and stuff, most of which I've paid no attention to. It's always seemed to me that you just should tell people the truth and that'll work. And in my experience, it has. I've never had any trouble. When I wrote The End of Nature, it was very widely read and understood. When we formed 350.org, we took a wonky scientific data point, the percentage of carbon that there should be. Wow, this is ridiculous. No one will ever. Well, nobody had any problem with it, I wrote a piece last year for Rolling Stone called The Terrifying New Math of Climate Change that was 6,000 words full of numbers, not at all an easy piece to read. And I think it turned into one of the most widely shared pieces in the magazine's history. So I've never really I mean, I know that people are forever thinking, oh, if we just figure out some new thing to call climate change, or if we, you know, say the magic word about green jobs or something, automatically it'll work. But I have not found that to be the truth. I mean, at this point, 75% of Americans know that climate change is real and want something done about it. The people who don't want anything done about it are the small number of people who are making an enormous amount of money doing what they're doing. And they're quite straightforward about it. I mean, we had a good discussion in this room with the ex-CEO of Shell not long ago, who explained just all that. And he's not alone. The CEO of Exxon went on Charlie Rose a few weeks ago, and Charlie Rose, in his avuncular way, leaned in and said, what is your philosophy? You know, I think he was sort of expecting the guy might come up with some, you know, sort of thing about serving the needs of the energy needs. My philosophy is to make money. Okay, so, you know, high marks for honesty.
Very honest.
Take them at their word. You know, I mean, there's no uninterested in science, uninterested in reason, interested in money. Okay.
And isn't that what shareholders expect in one of them?
Well, maybe, but that's why we're convincing lots and lots of shareholders that they don't want to be their shareholders anymore, because if they are, then they're implicated in what now is a kind of, you know, an almost outlaw industry. A group of people who, as that was the point of that Rolling Stone article, have in their reserves 5 times more carbon than the most conservative government or scientist says would be safe to burn. So if you're willing to profit from that, then, you know, you're by definition part of the problem here.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Got a letter from LBJ. It said, this is your lucky day. It's time to put your khaki trousers on. Though it may seem very clear, we've got no job to give you here, so we are sending you to Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese. I jumped off the old troop ship and sank in mud up to my hips. I cussed until the captain called me down. Never mind how hard it's raining. Think of all the ground we're gaining. Just don't take one step outside of town. Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese. Every night the local gentry slip out past the sleeping sentry. They go out to join the old VC. In their nightly little dramas, they put on their black pajamas and come lobbing mortar shells at me. But Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese. Go around in helicopters like a bunch of big grasshoppers searching for the Viet Cong in vain. They left the note that they had gone, had to get down to Saigon, their government positions to maintain. And Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese. Well, here I sit in this rice paddy, wondering about Big Daddy, and I know that Lyndon loves me so. Yet how sadly I remember way back yonder in November when he said I'd never have to go. But Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese.
Antonio Uhas?
Yeah, I think shareholders want to make a profit, but they also, I think, assume that there are limits being placed on the companies, which there aren't, and that there is, in fact, some sort of social environmental system, which used to, back in the day, be known as regulation, that used to be imposed by governments, that actually put some set of normalized restrictions on those activities, even of oil companies. And what I have learned is actually that many people are actually shocked to know that they're basically at this point, particularly thanks to the Bush administration, we've given this industry a free hand in where it'll operate under what basically with almost without restriction, almost without limitation, so that the idea that there is actually some sort of pushback on where you can operate, under what conditions, the impacts on whom, how they happen, that pushback doesn't exist anymore, and that was by design. I think also, you know, I think facts are very important. I think people care about facts, and then there's two other pieces to that. One is facts that are linked to a sense that there's something you can do about them as the person reading them. Yeah. So often facts can be disempowering if it feels that they're being presented in such a way that this horrible string of information is coming at you and there's nothing that you can do to change that string of information. It's one of the main problems with our modern news media right now is that we get these very snippets of information that aren't contextualized, that aren't told in a full story, that certainly aren't told in a way that's meant to include a sense of activism or people who are doing something about that problem, and all you are hit with as a consumer of the media is really sort of a bludgeoning of catastrophe after catastrophe. But then there also is the human side that is also missing, which is the story that I work very hard to tell on impacts of climate and impacts of the industry, which is it's not just this ephemeral idea that at some point some bad things are going to happen to us, but rather there are people who live every single day, not just on the front lines of climate change, but on the front lines of the operations of the oil industry and the fossil fuel industry, who are facing the true bludgeon, which is the bludgeon of these operations in exploration and production and refining and shipping and selling and consuming. And very rarely is their full voice told. And I think for the sort of average consumer, understanding the direct human impacts happening right now, the real facts, and the sense that you can actually do something about it is the, you know, sort of super circle that gets people into change. And then the final piece is that the oil industry isn't sitting blithely away and saying, all we want to do is make money. Of course, Exxon, the Koch brothers, all the major players are funding those who are trying to deny our facts. And they have often, because of their money, the capacity for a much louder voice. So what you end up with this, you know, the flooding of the climate deniers myth was that because there was so much money being spent on promoting the idea, that the average person who didn't necessarily know a lot about the facts said, well, if the scientists don't agree, who am I to know, right? And so part of our challenge was exposing, you know, who was actually creating these myths, who was supporting the five people who held one idea versus the 500,000 who held the other, so that your average consumer of information could sift through the facts. And I think we have successfully done that. But that's part of the challenge, is the industry isn't just sitting by, you know, waiting for us to throw up the information and then change the way they operate.
And Merchants of Doubt is one book that did that. They went back to the 50s and others. But energy suppliers would say, what about the demand side? It's easy to villainize oil companies, but we also derive benefits and jobs, et cetera, from energy. In fact, we had a person here on this stage a couple of days ago, Sam Avery, who wrote a book called The Pipeline and the Paradigm. He went down the whole route of the Keystone Pipeline and talked to people, and he said, look, people in energy companies are not evil. They're working within a system. They're responding to incentives and structures. And it was actually interesting that he said he didn't villainize people working in oil companies. But I want to have your thought on that.
I think the most important thing is you know, what are the oil companies doing in fossil fuel industry to limit our choices to make it more possible for us to get off of oil and other fossil fuels? So all of the work that's done to maintain the billions upon billions upon billions of subsidies and tax breaks that go to the fossil fuel industry that are absolutely not equaled by, but I would argue most importantly, the public transportation sector, which I feel is far more important than any other alternative that we can come up with. Money to go to the public transit system, which gives more people the opportunity to make the other choice, but obviously also funding for alternative energy and, you know, all the plethora of ways that we can commute in other manner. If the industry wasn't working so hard to make it harder for us to support the alternatives, we would have a much easier time to get off of fossil fuel altogether.
Suppressing competition, sure.
Bill, well, I mean, yes, Antonio's exactly right. You know, responding, as Sam said, responding to incentives and structures, the oil company. I mean, the oil companies create the set of incentives and structures to which they then respond. Go look at, for instance, on the Keystone Pipeline, you know, the amount of money spent lobbying and basically corrupting the system. Look in a larger sense at what the oil industry has been willing to do to maintain the greatest single special break that any industry's ever had. This is the only industry on Earth that's allowed to throw out its waste for free. They get to pour, and that's why they're the richest industry on Earth. If they were forced to account, as every economist that I know of by now has said they should be forced to account for the what the economists would call their externalities, they wouldn't be making that kind of money. In order to protect that, they spend more than anybody in D.C. and a lot of other capitals. I mean, you know, think about your hometown friends here, Chevron. 2 weeks before the last election, they gave the largest corporate campaign donation of the post-Citizens United era. It was designed to make sure that the House stayed in the hands of people who would do nothing to them. It was successful. Nothing will happen for the next couple of years. Until we face up to that, the incentives and structures will remain the same, and so will the outcome. It's not that that anyone's forcing them to play, you know, by a particular set of rules. They write the rules, and then they play the game.
And let's talk about divestiture. San Francisco voted recently to divest a number of college campuses around. What's your hope for that? You're obviously following the example of South Africa.
Look, we're not going to bankrupt Exxon by doing it, but we are going to start morally bankrupting them. We're going to start taking away their social license. We already are. On 340-some college campuses at the moment, there are dedicated groups of students making the case that good people should not be in bed with bad companies, that their future should not, you know, their education can't be paid for by investing in companies whose business plan guarantees there'll be no planet to carry that education out on. And they're doing it in beautiful solidarity with people all over the world. Earlier today at Bowdoin College and last night at Bowdoin College in Maine, students erected what they called a climate justice camp on the quad and spent the night, and I think they're going to spend a lot of nights there. They're saying, if our college thinks it's okay to make its money investing in companies who are creating climate refugees the world over, then we're going to live like climate refugees, because I guess that's, you know, good enough for Bowdoin. That's a powerful statement. And late this afternoon, I sort of sent out a little note about that, and late this afternoon got a message from one of our leaders on a small atoll in the Pacific saying, we are so grateful to young people in the United States for doing this, and we're so hopeful that their elders will pay some attention to them. I thought that was a powerful moment, and I think there's going to be a lot of powerful moments.
And I heard, Bill McKibben, I heard you say that when Nelson Mandela left South Africa for one of the first times, he went to UC Berkeley.
He went straight to the Bay Area. He didn't go straight to the White House. He went straight to the Bay Area, and he said, thank you, students, for forcing the divestiture of $3 billion worth of apartheid-tainted stock. You know, we fought for our own liberation, but we also needed your help doing this. That's why when we started this divestment campaign, one of the first people we called was our old friend who's been a help at 350 from the beginning, Desmond Tutu, and he made a little video for us. And he said, if you could see what climate change is doing to Africa, if you could see the famine and the drought, then you'd know why I'm asking you to take up this same tool again that you used a quarter century ago and stand up to the, because there's different kinds of oppression, you know. There's the very obvious kind where someone gives you a pass and makes you live in a particular place, and, you know, and then there's the kind where you can no longer feed your family because people at a great distance have changed the weather so that you can't grow food where, you know, 20 generations of people were able to grow food. And we got to stand up to both those kinds of oppression. They're very closely linked. And it's a moment, I mean, if one wants to say one good thing about climate change, about global warming, It's that it's a moment when we'll find out if we really can conceive of ourselves as a globe or not, if we can achieve that kind of solidarity. And if we do, it's largely going to be by rising up against the 1% of the 1% who are the people in charge of this industry.
Oh, dear me, I never know what to say at these UN cocktail parties. I never know what to say.
Well, I didn't expect to see you here, Pope Benedict.
Oh, my old friend, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. How are you? Good to see you.
Well, I'm doing very well. You know, I'm a big fan of yours. But it seems we have both said a few things that have got us in hot water lately, no?
Oh, tell me about it. It's very difficult to admit that you are wrong, especially when you're infallible. It's not easy being Pope. Having to spend each day with rosaries and such. When I think it would be cooler to be Buddhist or Amish or have something much more colorful where you don't spend all your time apologizing to altar boys or making the Muslim world upset.
Hey, it's not easy being me. Venezuela's got inflation through the roof. And so to keep my numbers up, I have to go to the UN and say things about George Bush like he's the devil, and I smell sulfur when that smell turned out to be John Bolton's cheap aftershave.
But Venezuela's got oil.
And popes wear really cool hats. And you've got throngs that adore you.
You've got something more too. You get to have sex. If Pope is all there is to be, with so much ire, I'm so tired. What if I get fired?
The next job we're headed for,
we'll join the Dixie Chicks on tour.
And now for something completely different.